Chapter 8. Francis. When did the pain start? Francis lay naked on a massage table, a soft white towel draped over her back. Everything off, and then under this towel, the massage therapist had barked when Francis arrived at the spa. She was a large woman with a grey buzz cut and the intimidating manner of a prison guard or a hockey coach. Not quite the soft-voiced, gentle masseuse Francis had been anticipating. Francis hadn't quite caught her name, but she'd been too distracted following instructions to ask her to repeat it. "About 3 weeks ago," said Francis. The therapist placed warm hands on her back, which seemed to be the size of ping-pong bats. Was that possible? Francis lifted her head to see them, but the therapist pressed against Francis's shoulder blades so her head fell forward again. "Did anything in particular set it off?"
"Not anything physical," said Francis, "but I did have kind of an emotional shock. I was in this relationship."
"So no physical injury of any sort," said the therapist, tersely.
Clearly she hadn't got the Tranquillum House memo about speaking in a slow, hypnotic voice. In fact, she was the opposite. It was like she wanted to get any speaking over and done with as quickly as possible.
"No," said Francis, "but I feel like it was definitely connected. I had a shock, you see, because this man I was dating, well, he disappeared, and I remember this very clearly. I was actually phoning the police when I felt this kind of sensation, like I'd been slammed."
"It's probably better if you don't talk," said the therapist.
"Oh, is it?" said Francis. "I was about to tell you a very interesting story, scary lady." She told the story a few times now, and she felt that she told it quite well. She was improving it with each telling. Also, she didn't have long before she had to stop talking for 5 days, and she wasn't sure how she was going to cope with so much silence. She'd only just avoided that terrifying abyss of despair in the car. Silence might tip her over again. The therapist pressed her giant thumbs on either side of Francis's spine.
"Ow!
Focus on your breathing." Francis breathed in the citrus-scented essential oils and thought about Paul. How it began. How it ended. Paul Drabble was an American civil engineer she met online. A friend of a friend of a friend. A friendship that turned into something more. Over a 6-month period, he sent her flowers and gift baskets and handwritten notes. They talked for hours on the phone. He'd FaceTimed with her and said he'd read 3 of her books and loved them. And he talked expertly about the characters and even quoted his favourite excerpts. And they were all excerpts that made Francis feel secretly proud. Sometimes people quoted their favourite lines to her and Francis thought, "Really? I thought that wasn't my best." And then she felt weirdly annoyed with them. He sent her photos of his son, Ari. Francis, who'd never wanted children of her own, fell hard for Ari. He was tall for his age. He loved basketball and wanted to play it professionally. She was going to be Ari's stepmother. She'd read the book Raising Boys in preparation and had a number of brief but pleasurable chats with Ari on the phone. He didn't say much, understandably. He was a 12-year-old boy, after all. But sometimes she made him laugh when they Skyped, and he had a dry little chuckle that melted her heart.
Ari's mother, Paul's wife, had died of cancer when Ari was in preschool. So sad. So poignant. So convenient, suggested one of Frances's friends, and Frances had slapped her wrist. Frances was planning to move from Sydney to Santa Barbara. She had her flights booked. They would need to get married to secure her green card, but she wasn't going to rush into things. If and when it happened, she planned to wear amethyst. Appropriate for a third wedding. Paul had sent her photos of the room in his house that he'd already set up as her writing room. There were empty bookshelves waiting for her books. When that terrible phone call came in the middle of the night, Paul, so distraught he could barely get the words out, crying as he told her that Ari had been in a terrible car accident and there was a problem with the health insurance company and that Ari needed immediate surgery, Frances didn't hesitate. She sent him money, a vast amount of money. "Sorry, how much?" said the young detective, who carefully wrote down everything Frances said, his professionalism slipping for just a moment. That was Paul's only misstep. He underplayed his hand. She would have sent double, triple, quadruple, anything to save Ari. And then terrifying silence. She was frantic. She thought Ari must have died. Then she thought Paul had died. No answers to her texts, her voicemail messages, her emails. It was her friend Di who made the first tentative suggestion. "Don't take this the wrong way, Frances, but is it possible that..." Di didn't even need to finish the sentence. It was as if the knowledge had been lurking away in Frances's subconscious all along, even while she booked non-refundable airfares. It felt personal, but it wasn't personal. It was just business. "These people are getting so smart," the detective had said. "They're professional and polished, and they target women of your age and circumstances." The sympathy on his handsome young face was excruciating. He saw a desperate old lady. She wanted to say, "No, no, I'm not a woman of age and circumstance. I'm me. You're not seeing me." She wanted to tell him that she had never had any trouble meeting men. She had been pursued by men all her life. Men who truly loved her, and men who only wanted to have sex with her. But they were all real men who wanted her for herself, not con artists who wanted her money. She wanted to tell him that she'd been told on multiple occasions by multiple sources that she was really very good in bed, and her second serve caused consternation on the tennis court. And although she never cooked, she could bake an excellent lemon meringue pie. She wanted to tell him she was real. The shame she experienced was extraordinary. She had revealed so much of herself to this scammer. How he must have sniggered, even as he somehow responded with sensitivity, humor, and perfect spelling. He was a mirage. A narcissistic reflection of herself, saying exactly what she so obviously wanted to hear. She realized weeks after that even his name, Paul Drabble, was probably designed to begin the act of seduction by subconsciously reminding her of Margaret Drabble, one of her favorite authors, as she had posted for all to see on social media. It turned out many other women had been planning lives as Ari's stepmother too. "There are multiple ladies in the same situation as you," the detective said. Ladies. Oh, my God. Ladies. She couldn't believe she was a lady. That sexless, gentrified word made Frances shudder. The details of each scam were different, but the boy's name was always Ari, and he always had a car accident. And the distraught phone call always came in the middle of the night. Paul Drabble had multiple names, each with a carefully curated online presence, so that when the ladies Googled their suitors, as they always did, they saw exactly what they wanted to see. Of course, he was not the friend of a friend of a friend. Or not in the real world way. He'd played a long game, setting up a fake Facebook page and pretending an interest in antique restoration furniture, which had got him accepted into a Facebook group run by a university friend's husband. By the time he sent Frances a friend request, she'd seen enough of his intelligent, witty, concise comments on her friend's posts to believe him to be a real person in her extended circle. Frances met up with one of the other women for coffee. The woman showed Frances pictures on her phone of the bedroom she'd created for Ari, complete with Star Wars posters on the wall. The posters were actually a little young for Ari. He wasn't into Star Wars, but Frances kept that to herself. The woman was in a far worse state than Frances. Frances ended up writing her a check to help her get back on her feet. Frances's friends spluttered when they heard this. Yes, she gave more cash to yet another stranger. But for Frances, it was a way of restoring her pride, taking back control, and fixing some of the trail of destruction left by that man. She did think a thank you card from her fellow scam victim might have been nice, but one mustn't give only in expectation of thank you cards. After it was all over, Frances packed away the evidence of her stupidity in a file. All the printouts of emails where she'd spilled her foolish heart. The cards that accompanied real flowers with fake sentiments. The handwritten letters. She went to shove the folder into her filing cabinet, and a sheet of paper sliced open her thumb like the edge of a razor blade. Such a tiny, trite injury, and yet it hurt so much. The therapist's thumbs moved in small, hard circles. A liquid warmth radiated across Frances's lower back. She looked through the hole in the massage table at the floor. She could see the therapist's sneaked feet. Someone had used a Sharpie to doodle flowers all over the white plastic toes of her shoes. "I fell for an internet romance scam," said Frances. She needed to talk. The therapist would just have to listen. "I lost a lot of money." The therapist said nothing, but at least she didn't order Frances to stop talking again. Her hands kept moving. "I didn't care so much about the money. Well, I did. I'd worked hard for that money. But some people lose everything in these kinds of scams, whereas I just lost my self-respect, I guess, and my innocence." She was babbling now, but she couldn't seem to stop. All she could hear was the therapist's steady breathing. "I guess I've always just assumed that people are who they say they are, and that 99% of people are good people. I've lived in a bubble. Never been robbed, never been mugged. Nobody has ever laid a hand on me." That wasn't strictly true. Her second husband hit her once. He cried. she didn't. They both knew the marriage was over in that moment. Poor Henry. He was a good man, but they brought out something terrible in each other, like allergic reactions. Her mind wandered off down the road of her long and complicated relationship history. She'd shared her relationship history with Paul Drabble, and he'd shared his. His had sounded so real. It must have had some truth to it. So says the novelist who makes up relationships for a living. Of course he could have fabricated his relationship history, you idiot. She kept talking. Better to talk than to think. I honestly thought I was more in love with this man than any other man I'd met in the real world. I was quite deluded. But then again, love is just a trick of the mind, isn't it? Just shut up, Frances. She's not interested. Anyway, it was all very... Her voice trailed off. Embarrassing. The therapist was completely silent now. Frances couldn't even hear her breathing. It was like being massaged by a giant-handed ghost. Frances wondered if she was thinking, I'd never fall for something like that. The sharpest knife point of her humiliation was this. Before, if Frances had been asked to pick the sort of person likely to fall for an internet scam, she would have chosen someone like this woman, with her bulky body, buzz cut, and questionable social skills. Not Frances. Frances said, I'm sorry, I missed your name before. Jan. Do you mind me asking, Jan, are you married? In a relationship? Divorced. Me too, said Frances. Twice. But I've just started seeing someone, offered Jan, as if she couldn't help herself. Oh, great! Frances's mood lifted. Was there anything better than a new relationship? Her whole career was based on the wonder of new relationships. How did you meet? She asked. He breath tested me, said Jan, with a laugh in her voice. The laugh told Frances everything she needed to know. Jan was newly in love. Frances's eyes filled with happy tears for her. Romance would never be dead for Frances. Never. So, he's a policeman? He's a new cop in Jarrabong, said Jan. He was bored sitting on the side of the road doing random breath testing, and we got chatting while he waited for another car to come along. It took 2 hours. Frances tried to imagine Jan chatting for 2 hours. What's his name? Asked Frances. Gus, said Jan. Frances waited, giving Jan the opportunity to wax lyrical about her new boyfriend. She tried to imagine him for herself. Gus, a local country cop, broad-shouldered with a heart of gold. Gus probably owned a dog, a lovable dog. Gus probably whittled. He probably had a tuneful whistle. He probably whistled while he whittled. Frances was already half in love with Gus herself. But Jan had gone silent on the subject of Gus. After a while, Frances kept talking, as if Jan had actually shown interest. You know, sometimes I think it was almost worth it, the money I paid, for the companionship over those 6 months. For the hope. I should email him and say, look, I know you're a scammer, but I'll pay you to keep pretending to be Paul Drabble. She paused. I would never really do that.
Silence.
It's funny because I'm a romance writer. I create fictional characters for a living. And then I fell for one.
Still nothing.
Jan mustn't be a reader.
Maybe she was just embarrassed for Frances.
Wait till I get home and tell Gus about this loser. Gus would give a long, low, tuneful whistle of surprise and sympathy.
That's what happens in the big smoke, Jan.
Frances managed to stay silent for a few moments as Jan kneaded her knuckle into a spot on her lower back. It hurt in a glorious, necessary feeling way.
Do you work full-time here, Jan?
Just casual, when they need me.
You like it?
It's a job.
You're very good at it.
Yep.
Extraordinarily good. Jan said nothing, and Frances closed her eyes.
How long have you worked here? She asked sleepily.
Only a few months, said Jan, so I'm still a newbie.
Frances opened her eyes. There was something in Jan's voice. Just a shadow. Was it possible she wasn't quite sold on the Tranquillum House philosophy?
Frances considered asking her about the missing contraband, but how would the conversation progress?
I think someone went through my bags, Jan.
Why do you think that, Frances?
Well, some things were missing.
What sort of things?
She was too ashamed and too vulnerable without her clothes on to confess.
What is the director like? Asked Frances, thinking of the reverence with which Yao had looked at that closed door.
Silence.
Frances watched Jan's feet in their chunky sneakers. They didn't move. Finally, Jan spoke.
She's very passionate about her work.
Yao had also said he was passionate about his work. It was the theatrical language of movie stars and motivational speakers. Frances would never say she was passionate about her work, although she was, in fact, passionate about her work. If she went too long without writing, she lost her mind.
What if she was never published again?
Why would anyone publish her again? She didn't deserve to be published.
Don't think about the review.
Passion is good, she said.
Yep,
said Jan. She chose another spot for knuckle digging.
Is she possibly too passionate at times? Asked Frances, trying to understand the point, if any, that Jan was trying to make.
She cares a lot about the guests here, and she's prepared to do whatever it takes to help them.
Whatever it takes, said Frances. That sounds...
Jan's hands moved to Frances's shoulders.
I need to remind you that the noble silence will begin in just a few moments. Once we hear the third bell, we're not allowed to talk.
Frances felt panicky. She wanted more information before this creepy silence began.
When you say, whatever it takes... I only have positive things to say about the staff here,
interrupted Jan. She sounded a little robotic now. They have your best interests at heart.
This is sounding kind of ominous, said Frances. People achieve great results here, said Jan.
Well, that's good.
Yep, said Jan.
So are you saying that some of their methods are possibly a little... Frances tried to find the right word. She was remembering some of those angry online reviews. A bell rang once. It reverberated with the melodic authority of a church bell, clear and pure.
Damn it!
Unorthodox? Continued Frances hurriedly. I guess I'm just cautious now after my experience with that man, that scammer. Once bitten... The second bell, even louder than the first, sliced through the middle of her cliché so that it hung foolishly in the air.
Twice shy, whispered Frances.
Jan pressed her palms down hard on Frances's shoulder blades as if she were performing CPR and leaned forward so that her breath was warm against Frances's ear.
Just don't do anything you're not comfortable with. That's all I can say.
The third bell rang. Chapter 9. Marsha.
The director of Tranquillum House, Maria Dmitrichenko, Marsha to everyone except the tax office, sat alone in her locked office at the top of the house as the third bell rang. Even from all the way up here, she could sense the silence fall. It felt like she'd walked into a cave or cathedral, that feeling of release. She bowed her head towards her favorite fingerprint-shaped wall in the surface of her white oak desk. She was on her third day of a water-only fast, and fasting always heightened her senses. The window of her office was open, and she breathed in great gusts of clean country air. She closed her eyes and remembered how she'd once breathed in all the strange, thrilling scents of this new country, eucalyptus, fresh-cut grass, and petrol fumes. Why was she thinking about this? It was because her ex-husband had emailed yesterday for the first time in years. She'd deleted his email, but just seeing his name for even an instant had infiltrated her consciousness, so that now the merest scent of eucalyptus on a breeze was enough to transport her back 30 years to the person she'd once been. Someone she could barely remember. And yet, she did remember everything about that first day. After those endless flights, Moscow, Delhi, Singapore, Melbourne, how she and her husband had looked at each other in the back of that little van, marveling at all the light. Even in the middle of the street, they'd whispered to each other about the way strangers kept smiling at them. It was bizarre the way they did this, so friendly. But then, it was Marsha who first noticed this. When they turned their heads, their smiles shrank to nothing. Smile gone. Smile gone. In Russia, people didn't smile like that. If they smiled at all, they smiled from the heart. That was Marsha's first ever experience of the polite smile. You could see the polite smile as a wonderful or terrible thing. Her ex-husband smiled back. Marsha did not.
Nu nachher!
She did not have time for the past right now. She had a health resort to run. People were depending on her. This was the first time she'd begun a retreat with a period of silence, but she knew already that it was right. The silence would give her guests clarity.
It would frighten some of them. They would resist, and people would break the silence, accidentally or deliberately. Couples might whisper in their beds, but that was fine. The silence would set the right tone going forward. Some guests treated this place like summer camp. Middle-aged women got overexcited at not having to cook dinner each night. All that high-pitched chatter. If two men became mates, you could be sure rules would be broken. In the early days, when Masha first opened Tranquillum House to the public, she'd been shocked to discover an order for a family-sized meat lover's pizza being delivered at the back fence.
«Ну что такое?»
she shouted, scaring the life out of both the poor delivery boy and the guest. «What's going on here?» She had learned the funny ways of her guests. Now she took precautions. Security cameras around the property, regular monitoring, bags were checked. All for their own good. She turned sideways in her chair and lifted one leg, pressing her forehead to her shin bone. She occupied her body with the ease of a 10-year-old boy, and she liked to say that she was only 10 years old, because it was coming up to the 10th anniversary of the day it happened, her cardiac arrest, the day she died and was born again. If not for that day, she would still be in the corporate world, and she would still be fat and stressed. She had been global operations director for a multinational producer of dairy products. She had been taking Australia's most trusted cheese to the world. She no longer ate cheese. She remembered her office with its views of the Sydney Opera House and the pleasure she once took in ticking off tasks, formulating policies to streamline procedures, bringing a room full of men to heal. Her life then had been spiritually void, but intellectually stimulating. She especially loved new product development and seeing the company's entire product line laid out on the boardroom table, the lushness of choice, the brightly colored packaging. In a strange way, it fulfilled the yearning she'd felt as a child when she flicked through illicit shopping catalogs from the West. But the pleasure she took in her corporate life had been like a polite smile. There was no substance to it. Her mind, body, and soul had operated like different divisions of a corporation, without a good flow of communication. This nostalgia she felt for her old job was as fraudulent as fond thoughts of her ex-husband. The memories her mind kept throwing up were nothing but computer glitches. She must focus. 9 people were depending on her. 9 perfect strangers, who would soon become like family. She ran her finger down a printout of their names. Francis Welty, Jessica Chandler, Ben Chandler, Heather Marconi, Napoleon Marconi, Zoe Marconi, Tony Hogburn, Carmel Schneider, Laz Lee. 9 strangers who, right now, were settling into their rooms, exploring the property, nervously reading their information packs, drinking their smoothies, perhaps enjoying their first spa treatments, worrying about what lay ahead. She loved them already. Their self-consciousness and self-loathing,
their manifest lies, their defensive jokes to hide their pain as they cracked and crumbled before her. They were hers for the next 10 days, hers to teach and nurture, to shape into the people they could be, should be. She found the file for the first name on her list. Frances Welty, aged 52. The photo she'd submitted showed a woman wearing red lipstick holding a cocktail. Masha had treated 100 women like Frances. It was simply a matter of peeling back their layers to reveal the heartache beneath. They longed to be peeled, for someone to be interested enough to peel them. It wasn't hard. They'd been hurt by husbands and lovers, by children who no longer needed them, by disappointing careers, by life, by death. They nearly all loathed their bodies. Women and their bodies. The most abusive and toxic of relationships. Masha had seen women pinch at the flesh of their stomachs with such brutal self-loathing, they left bruises. Meanwhile, their husbands fondly patted their own much larger stomachs with rueful pride. These women came to Masha overfed and yet malnourished, addicted to various substances and chemicals, exhausted and stressed, and experiencing migraines or muscular pain or digestive issues. They were easy to heal with rest and fresh air, nutritious food and attention. Their eyes brightened. They became expansive and exhilarated as their cheekbones reemerged. They wouldn't shut up. They left Masha with hugs and tears in their eyes and bright toot-toots of their car horns. They sent heartfelt cards, often with photos enclosed, showing how their journeys had continued as they applied Masha's lessons to their day-to-day lives. But then, 2, 3, 4 years later, a good proportion came back to Tranquillum House, looking as unhealthy as they'd been at their first visits, or even unhealthier. "I stopped my morning meditation," they would say, all wide-eyed and apologetic, but not that apologetic. They seemed to think their lapses were natural, cute, to be expected. "And next thing, I was back drinking every day. I lost my job. I got divorced. I had a car accident." Masha had only reset them temporarily. In times of crisis, they returned to their default settings. That was not good enough, not for Masha. This was why the new protocol was essential. There was no need for the strange anxiety that was waking her up in the dark of the night. The reason Masha had been so successful in her corporate career was because she had always been the one prepared to take risks, to think laterally. It was the same here. She tapped her fingertip against the bleary, bloated face of Frances Welty and checked to see which boxes she had selected for what she wanted to achieve over the next 10 days. Stress relief, spiritual nourishment, and relaxation. It was interesting that she hadn't ticked weight loss. It must be an oversight. She seemed like the careless sort. No attention to detail. One thing was clear. This woman was crying out for a spiritually transformative experience, and Masha would give it to her. She opened the next file.
Ben and Jessica Chandler. Their photo showed an attractive young couple sitting on a yacht. They were smiling with their teeth, but Masha couldn't see their eyes because of their dark sunglasses. They had ticked the box for couples counseling, and Masha was confident she could help. Their problems would be fresh, not calcified after years of arguments and bitterness. The new protocol would be perfect for them. Next up, Lars Lee, 40. The photo he'd attached was a glossy corporate headshot. She knew this type of guest very well. He saw attendance at health resorts as a part of his grooming regime, like a haircut or a manicure. He would not try to smuggle in contraband, but he would feel that inconvenient rules did not apply to him. His reaction to the new protocol would be interesting. Carmel Schneider, 39. Mother of young children, divorced. Masha looked at her photo and clucked. She heard her mother's voice. If a woman doesn't look after herself, her man looks after another woman. Poor little bunny. Low self-esteem. Carmel had ticked every single box on the list except for couples counseling. Masha felt lovingly towards her for this. No problem, my Lapochka. You will be one of my easy ones. Tony Hogburn, 56, also divorced, also here for weight loss. That was the only box he ticked. He would become grumpy and possibly aggressive when his body reacted to the changes in his self-medicating lifestyle. One to monitor. The next file made her frown. Could this be her wild card? The Marconi family. Napoleon and Heather, both aged 48. Their daughter, Zoe, aged 20. This was the first time a family group had booked in to do a Tranquillum House retreat. She'd had many couples, mothers and daughters, siblings and friends, but never a family. And the daughter was the youngest guest ever to come. Why would a perfectly healthy-looking 20-year-old choose to do a 10-day health retreat with her parents? Eating disorder? That could be it. They all looked underfed to Masha's practiced eye. Some sort of strange family dysfunction going on. Whoever filled in the questionnaire for the family's group booking had ticked only one box. Stress relief. The photo the Marconi family had submitted showed the three of them in front of a Christmas tree. It was clearly a selfie, because they had their heads at funny angles, trying to get into the camera frame. They were all smiling. But their eyes were flat and empty. What happened to you, my Lapochki? Chapter 10. Heather. As soon as the third bell rang, Heather Marconi felt the silence fall, as though a blanket had been gently dropped over Tranquillum House. It was remarkable how palpable it was. She hadn't been especially aware of any ambient noise beforehand. She had just come out of the bathroom when the bells began to ring, much louder and more commanding than she had anticipated. She had been of two minds as to whether she'd bother to go along with this absurd silence,
If they'd wanted a silent retreat, they would have booked a silent retreat. Thank you very much. But the religious sound of the bells froze her on the spot. Ignoring the silence now felt disrespectful, even in the privacy of their own room. Her husband sat on an antique sofa in the corner, his finger to his lips like a schoolteacher, because Napoleon was a schoolteacher, a beloved schoolteacher in a disadvantaged area. And you couldn't spend 25 years teaching geography to recalcitrant boys without bringing home some teacher-like habits. Heather thought, "Don't shush me, darling. I'm not one of your students. I'll talk if I want to talk." She met his eyes to give him a wink, and Napoleon's gaze skittered away as if he had something to hide. But he was always the one with nothing to hide. He was the open bloody book, and the reason he was avoiding her eyes was because the paperwork had specified no eye contact for the next 5 days, and Napoleon would never forget a rule or regulation, even one as pointless and arbitrary as this. What possible good could come of avoiding eye contact between husband and wife? But Napoleon was deeply respectful of road signs and tiny clauses on bureaucratic forms. For him, rules were about politeness and respect and ensuring the survival of a civilized society. She studied him as he sat in his too short dressing gown, his long hairy legs entwined. He had a feminine way of crossing his legs, like a supermodel being interviewed on a talk show. His two shorter, chunkier, older brothers gave him hell about the girly way he sat, but he just grinned and gave them the finger. His hair was still wet from their visit to the hot springs and swim in the pool. The hot springs were an easy walk from the back of the house down a generously signposted walking track. There had been nobody else around. They had found a secret grotto, a rocky, shaded pool just big enough for the three of them to sit in a semicircle and enjoy the views of the valley. Heather and Zoe had listened as Napoleon talked on and on about how the minerals in the water would help their circulation and reduce their stress levels and so on and so forth. She couldn't really remember what he'd said. Napoleon's conversation was like background noise in her life. A radio, permanently on talkback, only random phrases making their way into her subconscious. He had obviously been panicked at the thought of 5 days of silence and had been speaking even faster than usual, without pause, his voice bubbling endlessly, like the frothy, warm, sulfuric-smelling water that bubbled about their bodies. "Sweetheart, of course I can cope without speaking for 5 days," he'd reassured Zoe, who had looked at her father with genuine concern on her beautiful young face. "If you can cope without your phone and your mother can cope without caffeine, I can cope without conversation." Afterwards, the three of them had cooled off in the pool. The relief of the cold, blue, chlorinated water had been magical after the hot springs. Heather watched Zoe try to race her dad. He swam butterfly. She swam freestyle with a 5-second head start. He still won, even though he didn't want to win, but he couldn't get away with pretending to lose like when she was a kid. Then they sat by the pool, and Zoe told them a funny story about one of her university tutors that Heather didn't quite get, but she could tell by Zoe's face that it was meant to be funny, so it was easy to laugh. It had been a rare and special moment of happiness. Heather knew they would all three have noted it and hoped it was a sign of something good. And now they had to spend the next 5 days not talking. Heather felt a burst of powerful irritation, or perhaps it was simply her body demanding a macchiato, because this so-called holiday was not meant to be about suffering. There were undoubtedly multiple other health resorts that offered the same peaceful environment without these draconian deprivations. None of the three of them needed to lose weight. Weight was just not an issue for Heather. She weighed herself every morning at 6 on the dot, and if she ever saw the needle move in the wrong direction, she adjusted her diet. Her BMI was in the underweight category, but only by a kilo. She'd always been lean. Zoe sometimes accused Heather of having an eating disorder just because she was kind of picky about when and what she ate. She didn't put just anything in her mouth. Unlike Napoleon, who ate like a vacuum cleaner, hoovering up whatever was around him. Napoleon stood. He lifted his suitcase onto the bed, unzipped it, and removed a beautifully folded T-shirt, a pair of shorts, and some underpants. He packed like a soldier whose kit bag would be inspected. He took off his dressing gown and stood in all his skinny, white, hairy, naked magnificence. His uncharacteristic silence made him suddenly a stranger. The muscles on his back moved in unison like an exquisitely engineered machine as he pulled on his T-shirt. Napoleon's height and nerdy demeanor disguised his sexiness. The first time they had sex, all those years ago, Heather kept thinking to herself, well, this is a surprise, because who knew that a guy like Napoleon would have the moves? She'd liked him well enough. He was sweet and funny and attentive, but she'd kind of thought sleeping with him would be like doing community service. It was meant to be polite, friendly, thanks so much for dinner and the Kevin Costner movie, sex. Not mind-blowing sex. She knew Napoleon's memory of their first date was different from hers. His memory was wholesome and sweet and correct, the way the memory of a first date between a future husband and wife should be. Napoleon zipped up his shorts and buckled his belt. He slid the brown leather through the silver metal clasp with irritatingly quick, efficient moves. He must have felt her eyes upon him, but he didn't look at her. He was so determined to follow these silly rules, no matter what. He was such a good man, so fucking perfect in every fucking way. The rage hit her with the power and momentum of a contraction during active labor. There was no escaping it. She saw herself punching his face with a closed fist, crunching his cheekbone, the diamond cluster of her engagement ring breaking his skin over and over and over and over, blood dripping. The rage wrapped itself around her body, almost lifted her off her feet. She had to grip her toes to the floor to stop herself lunging at Napoleon as he zipped the bag back up and placed it on the floor in the corner of the room where nobody could trip over it. She focused on a point on the wall where there was a small island-shaped scratch in the wallpaper and used the variable breathing method she taught mothers to use during the transition phase of labor. Pant, pant, blow. He, he, who. Pant, pant, blow. Napoleon walked across the room and stepped out onto the balcony. He stood with his legs apart and his hands clenching the railing, as if he were on the deck of a lurching ship. The rage eased, receded, vanished. Done. She'd got through it again. The oblivious object of her rage bowed his head, exposing his defenseless white neck. He would never know. He'd be horrified and so deeply wounded if he ever knew the violence of her secret thoughts. Heather felt shaky. Her mouth tasted of bile. It was as though she'd just vomited. She opened her own suitcase and found shorts and a tank top. Later this afternoon, after the meditation, she would need to run. She wouldn't be relaxed after sitting and focusing on her breathing for an hour. She'd be on the verge of madness. Coming here was a mistake, an expensive mistake. They should have gone to a big anonymous hotel. She tied the laces on her runners with vicious tugs and opened her mouth to speak. She was definitely going to speak. This silence was unnecessary. They wouldn't speak in the presence of the other guests, but there was no need to maintain this awkward, weird, and unhealthy silence in the privacy of their own room. And what about poor Zoe, alone and silent in the room next door? Heather and Napoleon both panicked if she was alone in her bedroom at home for too long, which was hard because she was 20 years old and needed to study. If there had been no sound for a while, one of them would make an excuse to go and check on her. She never complained, and she never closed her door. But there were no family suites at Tranquillum House. They'd had no choice but to book her a single room. She said she was fine. She constantly reassured them she was fine. She was happy. She understood their need to be reassured. But she'd worked so hard this year, much too hard, tapping away grimly on her computer as if a media studies degree were a matter of life and death, and she deserved a break. Heather looked at the wall above their bed that separated their room from Zoe's and wished she could see straight through it. What was she doing right now? She didn't have her phone. 20-year-olds needed their phones by their sides at all times. Zoe found it stressful if her battery power dropped below 80%. They shouldn't be risking their daughter's mental health like this. Zoe didn't sleep alone in a bed until she was 10 years old. Had she ever stayed in a hotel room on her own before? Never. Zoe had been away on holidays with her girlfriends, but they would have always shared a room, or so Heather would have thought. She just broke up with her boyfriend, and now she is alone in her room with nothing but her thoughts. My God! Her heart raced. She knew she was catastrophizing. She is an adult. She's fine. Napoleon turned from the balcony, caught her eye, and once again dropped his gaze. Heather felt her molars grind. He'd be so disappointed in her if she spoke only 5 minutes into the noble silence. Jesus! This was unexpectedly hard. The silence made her thoughts scream. She hadn't realized how much distraction Napoleon provided with his incessant chatter. How ironic if she was the one who couldn't handle silence, not him. They didn't need silence or fasting or detoxification. They just needed a refuge from January. Last January, they'd stayed home, and that had been a disaster. It was even worse than the year before. It seemed that January was a cruel-eyed, clawed vulture that would terrorize Heather's tiny family forever. "Maybe we should go away this time," Napoleon had suggested a few months ago. "Somewhere peaceful and quiet." "Like a monastery," Zoe had said. Then her eyes brightened. "Or, I know, a health resort. We'll get Dad's cholesterol down." Napoleon's school had offered all the teaching staff free health assessments back in June, and Napoleon had been told his cholesterol was high and his blood pressure was becoming worrisome, and it was great that he exercised, but he needed to make dramatic changes to his diet. So Heather had Googled health resorts. Are you in need of significant healing? That was the opening line on the homepage for the Tranquillum House website. Yes, Heather had said quietly to her computer screen. Yes, we are. It seemed likely that Tranquillum House targeted people of a socioeconomic status a few income levels higher than those of a high school teacher and a midwife. But their last proper holiday had been years ago, and Napoleon's inheritance from his grandfather had been sitting there in a term deposit. They could afford it. There was nothing else they needed or wanted. Are you sure you want to be stuck with your parents at a health resort for 10 days? She'd asked Zoe. Zoe shrugged, smiled. I just want to spend this holiday sleeping. I'm so tired. Normal 20-year-old girls shouldn't be spending that much of their summer break with their parents. But then, Zoe wasn't a normal 20-year-old girl. Heather had clicked Book Now and instantly regretted it. It was strange how something could appear so attractive and then, the very moment you committed to it, become wildly unattractive. But it was too late. She'd agreed to the terms and conditions. They could change the time they went, but they couldn't get their money back. The three of them were doing a 10-day cleanse, whether they liked it or not. She'd spent days kicking herself. They didn't need to be transformed. There was nothing wrong with their bodies. Everyone always said the three of them were exercise fanatics. This wasn't the place for the Marconis. It was the place for people like that woman Napoleon had accosted on the stairs. What was her name? Frances. You could tell just by looking at her that she filled her life with lunches and facials and her husband's work functions. She looked vaguely familiar to Heather, probably because Heather knew so many women just like her, wealthy, middle-aged women who hadn't worked since before their children were born. There was nothing wrong with those women. Heather liked them. She just couldn't be with them for too long without succumbing to rage. They were utterly unscathed by life. The only thing they had to worry about was their bodies, because all that lunching didn't help their figures, so they needed to come to places like this to recharge and to hear the experts tell them the amazing news that if you eat less and move more, you will weigh less and feel better. Once the silence was over and they were allowed to talk again, Napoleon and Frances would get on like a house on fire. Napoleon would listen with genuine interest as Frances humble bragged about how her children were studying at Harvard or Oxford or taking a gap year in Europe, where they seemed to be visiting more nightclubs than museums. Heather wondered idly if she should suggest to Napoleon that he take the opportunity to have an affair while they were here. Perhaps the poor man craved sex, and Frances would be a fine, buxom choice. Heather knew the exact date she'd last had sex with her husband. It was 3 years ago. If she'd known it was going to be the last time she'd have sex for the rest of her life, she might have bothered to remember the details. She was sure it was good. It generally was good. It just wasn't possible anymore. Not for Heather. She sat on the end of the bed, and Napoleon came and sat down next to her. She could feel the warmth of his body along hers, but their bodies didn't touch, as per the rules. They waited for Zoe, who was going to knock on their door once she was showered. That was the plan. Then the three of them would wait, silently, for the bell and go downstairs together for the first guided sitting meditation. Zoe was fine. Of course she was fine. She was a good girl. She would do what she said she would do. She always did. She tried so hard to be everything for them, while they tried so hard to pretend that she wasn't their only reason for living. Heather felt the pierce of grief, as sharp as a samurai sword. She could always hide the rage, but never the grief. It was too visceral. She put her hand to the base of her throat and a tiny mouse-like sound escaped. "Just ride it out, sweetheart," murmured Napoleon. He spoke so quietly, it was almost a whisper. Without looking at her, he took her hand, enfolding it in the warmth of his palms, breaking his beloved rules for her. She clutched at him, her fingers locked into the grooves between his knuckles, like a woman in labor holds her partner's hand as the pain tries to drag her away. Chapter 11. Francis. The bell rang for the first guided sitting meditation, and Francis opened the door of her room at the same time as Ben and Jessica next door. Nobody said anything, which Francis found almost unendurable, and they all avoided eye contact as they walked down the corridor towards the stairs. Ben wore the same clothes as earlier, while Jessica had changed into skin-tight yoga gear, revealing a figure so magnificent Frances wanted to compliment her on her efforts. It took a lot of commitment and silicon to look that good, and yet the poor kid didn't sashay as she deserved. Rather, she scurried, her shoulders hunched as though she were somewhere out of bounds and trying to escape notice. Ben, on the other hand, had the stiff, stoic walk of a man being taken off to prison for a crime to which he'd pled guilty. Francis wanted to take them both out to a bar and listen to their life stories while they all ate peanuts and drank sangria. Why was she even thinking about sangria, for heaven's sake? She hadn't drunk sangria in years. It was like her brain kept tossing out random suggestions for every type of food or drink she was going to be denied for the next 10 days. Just ahead of them on the stairs was the chatty giant Napoleon, together with his family. The mother was Heather, Heather like leather. The daughter was not showy Zoe. "Well done, Francis. You're a genius." Although, what was the point of her excellent name-remembering skills? She wasn't at a cocktail party. She wasn't even allowed to look at them. Napoleon walked in a very odd way, head bowed like a monk, each leg lifted and dropped with agonizing slowness, as though he were pretending to be a spacewalker. Francis was nonplussed for a moment, and then remembered the instructions about mindful walking during the silence. She slowed her pace and saw Jessica flick Ben on the arm to tell him to do the same. All six of them walked down the stairs in mindful, heel-to-toe slow motion, and Frances tried not to notice the absurdity of it. If she started laughing, she would become hysterical. She was already quite light-headed from hunger. It had been hours since she licked the Kit Kat wrapper. Everyone yielded to Napoleon as the most enthusiastically mindful walker, and they all followed him mindfully through the house, and then down the stairs
to the cool and dark yoga and meditation studio. Frances took her place on one of the blue mats towards the back of the room and attempted to imitate the posture of the two wellness consultants who sat in the front corners of the room, like exam supervisors, except that their legs were folded like origami, their hands resting on their knees, thumbs and fingers touching, irritating half smiles on their smooth, tranquil faces. She noted once again the big television screen and wondered if desperate guests ever crept down in their pajamas and tried to get a late-night TV fix. Although, there didn't seem to be a remote anywhere. As she tried to make herself comfortable, she registered a slight but noticeable improvement in her back after her massage. The pain was still there, but it was like one of the multiple bolts had been fractionally loosened. She sniffed. She understood from her long-ago course that meditation was mostly about breathing correctly, and right now she couldn't breathe. People would think of her as the aggravating, sniffling lady at the back of the room, and when she inevitably fell asleep, she'd suddenly jerk awake after doing one of those loud, snorty snores. Why hadn't she gone on a cruise? She sighed and looked around the room for guests she hadn't yet met. To the right of her was a man of about her own age, with a pallid, unhappy face. He sat stolidly on his mat, with his legs stuck straight out in front of him, cradling his big, solid belly on his lap as if it were a baby that had been handed to him without his consent. Frances smiled kindly at him. It was nice to see someone here who truly needed a health resort. His eyes met hers. Wait. No, please, no. Her stomach lurched. It was the man who had stopped on the side of the road and witnessed her screaming and banging on her horn like a lunatic. It was the man with whom she had freely discussed her menopausal symptoms. The serial killer on vacation. She had not cared what the serial killer thought of her because she was never going to see him again. She had never considered that he might also be checking into Tranquillum House because he was driving in the opposite direction, away from Tranquillum House, deliberately misleading her. This was fine. This was highly embarrassing, but fine. She smiled again, her mouth pulled down in a self-deprecating way to show that she was mildly mortified that she was going to spend the next 10 days with him after he'd witnessed her roadside meltdown. But she was a grown-up. He was a grown-up. What the heck? He sneered at her. He absolutely, most definitely sneered at her. And then he looked away. Fast. Frances loathed him. He had been so arrogant on the side of the road, telling her he couldn't let her drive. Was he the police? No. She felt like they were generally better groomed. Of course, she would absolutely give the serial killer the chance to redeem himself. First impressions could be wrong. She'd read Pride and Prejudice. But she rather hoped he would continue to be loathsome for the next 10 days. It was invigorating. Probably speeded up the metabolism. Two more guests came into the room, and Frances gave them her full attention. She would befriend them the moment she was allowed to speak. She was excellent at making friends. She felt quite sure that the serial killer was not excellent at making friends, and she would therefore win. The first was a woman, whom Frances guessed to be in her mid to late 30s, wearing an oversized, brand-new-looking white T-shirt, that hung almost to her knees, over black leggings. The standard outfit for an average-sized woman who starts a new exercise program and thinks her perfectly normal body should be hidden. Her thick black woolly hair was tied back in a long braid with glinting grey strands, and she wore red-rimmed cat's-eye glasses. Statement glasses, favoured by those who want to appear quirky and intellectual. Frances had a pair. The woman had a flustered look about her, as if she'd only just made her bus, and she had lots of other places to be today and might need to leave early. The flustered lady was followed by an astonishingly handsome man with high cheekbones and flashing eyes, who paused at the front of the room as if he were a movie star walking out onto the set of a chat show to rapturous applause. He was perfectly stubbled, perfectly proportioned, and deeply, deservedly, in love with himself. Frances wanted to laugh out loud at the sight of him. He was too good-looking even to be the tall, dark and handsome hero in one of her books. The only way it would work would be if she put him in a wheelchair. He'd look great in a wheelchair. Honestly, she could probably get away with removing both his legs and he could still play the lead. He sat himself down on a yoga mat in the easy manner of someone with a daily yoga practice. The tendons of Frances's neck began to ache from the strain of trying to hold her body so she didn't see the serial killer in her peripheral vision. She rolled her shoulders. Sometimes she exhausted herself. She turned her head and looked directly at him. He sat slumped, poking his finger into a hole near the hem of his T-shirt. She sighed, looked away. He wasn't even worth loathing. Now what? Now, nothing. They were all just sitting here, waiting. What were they meant to be doing? The desire to interact was an irresistible itch. Jessica, who sat directly in front of Frances, cleared her throat as if she were about to speak. Someone else coughed discreetly at the back of the room. Frances threw in a cough too. Her cough sounded quite bad, actually. She probably had a chest infection. Would they have antibiotics here? Or would they try to cure her with natural supplements? In which case, she'd get sicker and sicker and eventually die. All this coughing and clearing of throats reminded her of being in church. When had she last been in a church? It must have been for a wedding. Some of her friends' children were starting to get married. Girls who wore fuck-me boots in the 80s were now wearing mother-of-the-bride outfits with pretty bolero jackets to conceal their upper arms. At least at a wedding, you could quietly chat to the other guests while you waited for the bride. Compliment your friend on her pretty bolero jacket. This was more like a funeral, although even funerals weren't this silent as people murmured their soft condolences. She was paying to be here, and it was worse than a funeral. She looked dolefully around the room. There were no nice stained glass windows to enjoy, like in a church. There were no windows or natural light at all. It was almost dungeon-like. She was in a dungeon on an isolated property with a group of strangers, at least one of whom was a serial killer. She shivered violently. The air conditioning was on too high. She thought of the inscription Yao had showed her from the convict stonemasons and wondered if the place might be haunted by their tortured spirits. She'd set a couple of her books in haunted houses.
It was helpful for when you wanted your characters to leap into each other's arms. Napoleon sneezed, a high-pitched shriek of a sneeze, like a dog's yelp.
Gesundheit,
cried the handsome man. Francis gasped. He'd broken the noble silence already. The handsome man clapped his hand to his mouth. His eyes danced. A wave of laughter ballooned in her chest. Oh, God, it was like trying not to laugh in class. She saw the handsome man's shoulders shake. He chuckled. She giggled. In a moment, she'd be crying with laughter, and someone would order her to leave the room until she could control herself.
Namaste. Good afternoon.
The atmosphere changed instantly as a figure strode into the room, altering the particles of air around her, drawing every eye, bringing the coughs and sneezes and throat clearing to an instant halt. The laughter trapped in Francis's chest vanished. The handsome man went still.
A very warm welcome to Tranquillum House. My name is Masha.
Masha was an extraordinary-looking woman, a supermodel, an Olympic athlete, at least 6 feet tall, with corpse-white skin and green eyes so striking and huge they were almost alien-like. In fact, Masha did seem like a different species, a superior species to every other person in the room, even the handsome man. Her voice was low and deep for a woman, with an attractive accent that made certain syllables shift sideways. Namaste became Namaste. The cadence of her speech rolled back and forth between broad Australian and what Francis picked as exotic Russian. Indeed, the woman could easily be a Russian spy, a Russian assassin. Like all the staff, she wore white, except on her it looked less like a uniform and more like a choice. The perfect choice. The only choice. The muscles on her arms and legs were sculpted in clean, sleek lines. Her hair was bleached platinum and cut so short she'd be able to shake her head, dog-like, when she got out of the shower and be ready to face the day. As Francis's eyes ran over Marsha's exquisitely toned body and compared it to her own, she sank into herself. She was Jabba the Hutt, all pillowy bosom and hips and soft oozing flesh.
"Stop it," she told herself. It wasn't like her to indulge in self-loathing.
Yet it would be disingenuous to deny the aesthetic pleasure of Marsha's body. Francis had never bought into everyone is beautiful, a platitude only women had to be sold, as men could be beautiful or not without feeling as though they weren't really men. This woman, like the handsome man, had a dramatic, almost shocking physical presence. Francis had to talk or write or flirt or joke or in some way act before she could make an impact on people around her. Otherwise, as she knew from experience, she could stand at a counter in a shop and be ignored forever. No one could ignore Marsha. All she had to do for attention was exist. For a long, agonizing moment, Marsha surveyed the room, turning her head in a slow arc that took in their cross-legged, silent subservience. "There's something demeaning about this," thought Francis. "We're sitting at her feet like kindergarten kids. We're silent,
she speaks. Also, the rule was no eye contact, and yet Marcia appeared to be inviting it. She set the rules so she could break them. I'm paying for this, thought Frances. You work for me, lady. Marcia met Frances's gaze with warmth and humour. It was as if she and Frances were old friends, and she knew exactly what Frances was thinking and found her adorable for it. At long last, she spoke again.
I thank you for your willingness to take part in the noble silence.
I thank you. She paused.
I understand that some of you may find this period of silence particularly challenging. I understand, too, that the silence was unexpected. Some of you may be experiencing feelings of frustration and anger right now. You may be thinking, but I didn't sign up for this. I understand. And to you, I say this. Those of you who find the silence the most challenging will also find it the most rewarding.
Thought Frances. We'll see about that.
Right now, you're at the foot of a mountain, Marcia continued, and the summit seems impossibly far away. But I am here to help you reach that summit. In 10 days, you will not be the person you are now. Let me be clear on this, because it's important.
She paused again. She looked slowly around the room, as if she were satirizing a politician. The drama of her delivery was so deliberately hyperbolic, it wasn't even funny. It should have been funny, yet it wasn't. Marcia repeated,
In 10 days, you will not be the person you are now.
No one moved. Frances felt hope rise in the room, like a delicate mist. Oh, to be transformed, to be someone else, to be someone better. You will leave Tranquillum House feeling happier, healthier, lighter, freer, said Marcia. Each word felt like a benediction. Happier, healthier, lighter, freer. On the last day of your stay with us, you will come to me and you will say this, Marcia, you were right. I am not the same person I was. I am healed. I am free of all the negative habits and chemicals and toxins and thoughts that were holding me back. My body and mind are clear. I am changed in ways I could never have imagined. What a load of crap, thought Frances, while simultaneously thinking, please let it be true. She imagined driving home in 10 days. Pain-free, energized, her head cold cured, her back as flexible as an elastic band. The hurt and humiliation of her romance scam long gone, washed clean. She would walk tall, stand tall. She would be ready for whatever happened with the new book. The review would have faded to nothing. She could actually feel the review right now, like a sharp-edged corn chip stuck in her throat, making it hard to breathe and swallow. She might even, and here she felt a burst of childlike anticipation, as if for Christmas Day, be able to zip that amazing Zimmerman dress all the way up again, the one that used to guarantee her compliments, often from other people's husbands, which was always so pleasing.
Perhaps her transformed self would go home and write a thriller or an old-fashioned murder mystery, featuring a cast of colourful characters with secrets and a delightfully improbable villain. It might be fun to murder someone with a candlestick or a cup of poisoned tea. She could set it at a health resort. The murder weapon could be one of those stretchy green elastic bands she'd seen in the gym. Or she could make it more of a historical health resort, where everyone wafted about looking pale and interesting as they recovered from tuberculosis. She could surely throw in a romantic subplot. Who didn't like a romantic subplot?
There will be surprises on this journey, said Masha. Each morning at dawn, you will receive your daily schedule. But there will be unexpected detours and plans that change. I know this will be difficult for some of you who hold your lives with tight fists.
She held up her fists to demonstrate her point and smiled. It was a stunning smile, warm and radiant and sensual. Frances found herself smiling back and looked around the room to see if everyone else was similarly affected. Yes, indeed. Even the serial killer smiled at Masha, although it seemed as if his lips had been forced up only temporarily without his consent, and the moment he got control back, he was once again slack-jawed and sullen, pulling at a piece of thread on the fraying edge of his T-shirt.
Imagine you are a leaf in a stream, said Masha. Relax and enjoy the journey. The stream will carry you this way and that, but it will carry you forward to where you need to go.
Napoleon nodded thoughtfully. Frances studied the still, straight backs of Ben and Jessica in front of her, somehow vulnerable in their slim youthfulness, which didn't make sense because they probably didn't say, "Ugh," each time they stood up from a chair. Ben turned towards Jessica and opened his mouth as if he were about to break the silence, but he didn't. Jessica moved her hand and the light bounced off an enormous diamond on her finger. Good Lord, how many carats was that thing?
Before we begin our first guided meditation, I have a story to share, said Masha. 10 years ago, I died.
Well, that was unexpected. Frances sat a little straighter. Marcia's face became oddly jovial.
If you don't believe me, ask Yao.
Frances looked across at Yao, who seemed to be trying not to smile.
I went into cardiac arrest, and I was clinically dead.
Marcia's green eyes shone with crazy joy, as if she were describing the best day of her life. Frances frowned. Wait, why did you mention Yao? Was he there? Keep your narrative on track, Marcia.
They call my experience a near-death experience, said Marcia, but I feel that is the wrong terminology, because I wasn't just near death. I was dead. I experienced death, a privilege for which I am eternally grateful. My experience, my so-called near-death experience, was ultimately life-changing.
There were no coughs, no movement in the room. Were people rigid with embarrassment or still with awe? Here comes the tunnel of light, thought Frances.
Hadn't they proved there was a scientific reason for that phenomenon? Yet even as she scoffed, she felt a tingle of goosebumps.
That day, 10 years ago, I temporarily left my body, said Masha.
She said this with casual conviction, as if she didn't expect to be doubted.
Her eyes swept the room. There may be doubters among you. You may be thinking, did she really die? Let me tell you, Yao was one of the paramedics who took care of me that day.
She nodded at Yao, who nodded back.
Yao can confirm that my heart did indeed stop. We later developed a friendship and a mutual interest in wellness.
Yao nodded even more vigorously. Did Frances imagine it, or did the other wellness consultant roll her eyes at that? Professional jealousy? What was her name again? Delilah. What happened to Delilah after she cut off Samson's hair? Frances longed to Google it. How was she going to cope for 10 days without instant answers to idle questions?
Masha continued to speak. I wish I could tell you much more about my near-death experience, but it is so hard to find the right words, and I'll tell you why. It is simply beyond human comprehension. I don't have the vocabulary for it.
At least give it a shot. Frances scratched irritably at her forearm, which she understood from a clickbait article to be a symptom of Alzheimer's, although she couldn't be 100% sure because she couldn't goddamn Google it.
I can tell you this, said Masha. There is another reality that sits alongside the physical reality. I now know that death is not to be feared.
Although still best avoided, thought Frances. The more earnest people got, the more flippant she became. It was a flaw.
Death is simply a matter of leaving behind our earthly bodies.
Masha moved her own earthly body with unearthly grace. She seemed to be demonstrating how one shrugged off a body.
It is a natural progression, like walking into another room, like leaving the womb.
She stopped. There was movement at the back of the studio. Frances turned and saw the youngest person there, Zoe, stand from her cross-legged position in one fluid movement.
Sorry, she said in a low mumble.
Frances noticed Zoe's ears were studded with a multitude of earrings in unusual spots Frances didn't even know it was possible to pierce. Her face was pale. She was so exquisite and heartbreaking just because she was young, or maybe just because Frances was old.
Excuse me.
Both her parents looked up at her in alarm, their hands outstretched as if to grab her. Zoe shook her head violently at them.
Bathrooms are just over there, said Masha.
I just need a little air, said Zoe.
Heather got to her feet. I'll come with you.
Mum, no, I'm fine, said Zoe. Please, just let me...
She indicated the door. Everyone watched to see who would prevail.
I'm sure she is fine, said Masha decisively. Come back when you are ready, Zoe. You are tired after your long journey, that's all.
Heather surrendered with obvious reluctance and sat back down.
Everyone watched Zoe leave. The room felt unsettled now, as if Zoe's departure had put things out of balance. Marcia breathed in deeply through her nostrils and out through her mouth. Someone spoke.
Listen, now this, noble silence has been broken. Could I ask a question?
It was the serial killer. He spoke belligerently, just like a serial killer, his mouth barely open so that his words came out in pellets. He was clearly very upset. Frances saw Marcia's eyes widen ever so slightly at this infraction.
If you feel it's important right now.
He jutted his chin.
Did someone go through our bags?